Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's so much that I loved about my time performing in a ring. All of my animosity comes from what happened behind the curtain.
What three wrestling matches would you watch if you were stranded on a desert island? This is what I'm asking wrestling's best. In the ring, around the ring, behind the scenes, or behind a microphone. I'm Tom Campbell. Thank you for joining me on Cultaholic Island for another episode of Desert Island Graps.
And they were fitting all by himself. Ducks in the clothesline. Amas is catching his spot.
What?
Mesmerizing.
He's using hypnosis!
Is that legal here?
This can't be legal in international rules!
Look at it! It's working!
He's hypnotizing the entranceway, too!
Different, but effective. What the hell is going on?
How is this legal?
Oh, man.
The locker room when he looked at the entrance. This is the most illegal thing I've seen in the history of wrestling.
How are we not hypnotized?
He didn't look at
us. Hey, it's ultraviolet dancing. You gotta love the action here in CZW. It's like nothing else.
He's cutting a line or cutting a rug or whatever it's called.
Ophidian, how are you doing?
My friend, I am wonderful. Yes, yes, yes. I'm loving life currently, and I'm excited to be here today with you. Before we get into the interview, there's something that I must do for you.
Oh, okay.
Let's introduce myself, my friend. I am venomous. I am vile. I am the master of snake style, the Cobra Supernova. Ophidian.
Apologies. We should have done that off the bat. That's how you roll with it. Do you... Is it frustrating when you have ring announcers that don't get that right?
Yeah, I have a shortened and a longer version for the ring announcers that do and don't get it right, or, you know, didn't get it right.
What's the long version?
I am the venomous and vile serpent of the Nile, the one and only master of snake style. It rhymes, you know, like there's a rhythm, there's a flow to it.
It's beautiful. Who's your favorite ring announcer that's ever ring announced that?
There are two I'm really fond of. MLJ, he's the current GCW ring announcer, and Larry Legend, who is, you know, has been all over for ring announcing in the eastern side of the country.
Both good eggs. So now the introductions are out of the way. We've got to talk about your cat.
Oh yeah.
You had a cat. Your cat went viral over the summer.
It did. He did. So we've been posting videos of my cat playing the piano for a long time, for years at this point. He's been playing the piano since he was a kitten. But we had an issue where he was becoming a bit overweight. The doctor, the vet, recommended that he lose some weight. So one of the things we started doing was obviously reducing his food intake and telling him that if he wanted food, he had to be more active, essentially by playing the piano and communicating with us. So we posted video footage of that, of him stroking the keys, demanding food from us, meowing very loudly while playing the piano, and it went viral. It ended up on a couple of TV shows over here in America, and a ton of news sites.
So, when your, 'cause I've only seen a few of these that I'm aware of. Now you've talked about it, I have actually seen. It's weird when someone talks about a video and you go, I have seen that. I have actually seen that. Have you tried him with other musical instruments, or is it just a piano?
It's just a piano currently. We are a musical household. I'm looking over to my left, and there are three ukuleles and a charanga hanging from our wall. And to my right is a bass and a guitar, an acoustic guitar and a bass. So, like, we are definitely a household that has the instruments, but he only has interest in the piano.
What was the first instrument you learned to play?
I learned my first instrument over the quarantine. Throughout, I started playing bass. My wife is the musician in this family. But my first instrument was the bass, and then I learned how to play the Glockenspiel as well.
So you picked some random one. Well, obviously the bass is not so random, but the Glockenspiel. Like, mm-hmm. what made you decide to pick up the Glockenspiel?
My wife has many instruments in our home, being the musician that she is. And so my wife does a weekly stream on Twitch, the Lullaby Lounge, which is nice. And I joined in the Lullaby Lounge and have been helping her produce it. I've been sitting on the, directing the stream and being the button pusher and helping build the video packages and such. But on the show, I will also play an instrument if the audience redeems enough channel points in order for me to do so. So if they do a call for backup, I join in on instrument.
Nice. I did see you guys at a Halloween stream together
yes.
recently. Are you big fans of Halloween?
Absolutely. It's my favorite holiday. I think it's the only worthwhile holiday in the world. Like, that is worth the entire world stopping what they're doing and celebrating, I absolutely love it. I'm a massive, horror movie fan, and I get dressed up every day of the year, all day, as you can see right now. I know the audience can't see this, but, we're in a video chat, and here I am sitting in my mask in my home.
Yeah, because before we've even gotten to the wrestling stuff, like there's a fascinating story just by where you are. You're in a room which has got acoustic guitars and instruments surrounding it, and then behind you, you've got your paraphernalia for mask building and ring attire making, because you and your wife make wrestling attire as well, and you make your own masks as well. I know that much. I want to get into all of that. But before we do, we've got to get the ball rolling on this, Ophidian, because we're going to take you out of that room and send you to a metaphorical desert island. And while you are there, you're allowed to watch three wrestling matches that will burn onto a DVD for you. So you have the unenviable task of, throughout this podcast, choosing three wrestling matches that you will watch while you are there. So what would you like your first wrestling match to be, Ophidian?
Well, first, I'd like to point out just how nice your voice got there when you were like, you're gonna be on an island. We're going to give you a DVD with three matches. Like, oh, well, thank you. You've definitely eased this transition for me.
I thank you.
Into the island.
I appreciate it.
So I thought long and hard about this, and I went into what I really love about professional wrestling. And I love, obviously, the fighting aspect of it. I want to see wrestlers do the moves that they do. I want to see wrestlers fly off the top rope. I want to see how they play to the crowd. Like, I want every single aspect of it. I love everything about pro wrestling, from the wacky and comical side of it to the super serious, technical side of it. But I think if I'm stuck on a desert island and I do have to rewatch stuff, there are specific types of things I want to rewatch. And the first one I'd go with is John Cena versus Eddie Guerrero in the street fight they had on SmackDown, the parking lot brawl match they had.
And the rules are simple. Anything goes in this Latino Heat parking lot brawl. Eddie with a shot with that U.S. title to the gut, and this one's underway. This is extremely dangerous.
Well, this is just a fight. It's just a plain, good old-fashioned fight. Latino Heat parking lot brawl, actually.
Eddie Guerrero demanded this matchup last week. Stephanie McMahon, the general manager, granted it after John Cena stole Eddie Guerrero's lowrider. Wow, and don't forget the embarrassment, the humiliation Cena caused Guerrero in front of his family and friends in his hometown a couple of weeks ago.
Well, both Cena and Guerrero using these cars, the hoods of these cars as weapons, and that's what you need to do. You gotta use these cars as weapons.
This is like something right off the streets of Brooklyn.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Oh, Cena up off the hood into the windshield.
This match is shot more theatrically than wrestling was doing at the time, right? This is like 2006 era of SmackDown. This is the Paul Heyman, you know, era, kind of like post-Paul Heyman era SmackDown. The way they're shooting Cena, where he's surrounded by cars, you know, in the garage, wherever they're at, and all the wrestlers are kind of surrounding him, and they've got their weapons and stuff that they're just kind of hanging out and making it look super cool and edgy. But the way that they're kind of circling Cena and the way they zoom in and out on him is really theatrical. And I loved that promo leading up to the match that they had, which ended with Eddie Guerrero doing a frog splash off of one car onto the hood of another car. You know, like, just so many little things, pulling out a lawnmower and attempting to, you know, like, to hit John Cena with it. The fighting in the car when they're smashing each other's head into the steering wheel, like some really basic comedy stuff, but also just it was fun to see Eddie Guerrero in that setting with, at the time, a very serious John Cena. And the build up to the match and the match itself was a blast. The finish was great. It was one of those matches that when I saw it, reminded me a lot of what I enjoyed out of martial arts films and stuff from, or kind of like martial arts type fights and action sequences from movies, and drew me right in. You know, like I was in love with it.
Can you remember where you were when you watched it for the first time?
Yeah, I would have definitely been still living at home, watching it with, usually we watched SmackDown at the time with, you know, amongst our friends and stuff. So, actually, no, I wouldn't. This is before I moved back home. So yeah, I was in my apartment. I was watching it with my roommates, and we were just crazy hyped about it because we all loved John Cena at that time. The Thugonomics John Cena was top tier Cena.
How many of your roommates were wrestling fans? Was it all of you or was it just a few of you?
Yeah, the guys I backyarded with growing up, we lived together as well. So my best friend for many years, who was also my tag team partner, Amasis, lived with me for a period of time, as well as another one of our friends who got into pro wrestling but necessarily didn't make it, you know, out of very far into it. So didn't make it out of training.
You said that your backyard friends, so this was a backyard wrestling promotion that you were part of.
Yes.
How did you guys all come together then to form this? Were you living together at the time and you went, let's just put on a wrestling show?
So we started backyarding. You know, there was that massive craze I'll take it even further back. I grew up with somebody like Amasis. We were best friends growing up. Like, we rode the elementary school bus together, you know, like that kind of friendship. You know, like, we met each other in elementary school or grade school for the British folks, like, you know, first, second grade kind of deal. And we wrestled with each other in the parks, you know, like with our friends and stuff, like kind of like in the way that kids wrestle, you know, they imitate their wrestling moves and they, you know, they yell catchphrases and stuff. And as we got older and started to hit high school, you know, as we got a little more athletic and we got access to things that we could buy ourselves, like, you know, like some form of income, whether it was allowance or, you know, like starting to work. Like, I had my first job when I was 13. So like, I always had, you know, like some little form of income buying little things like weaponry and stuff. And we started to form our backyard fed. So this happened very early in high school with a bunch of us in school. My high school, my promotion, because I ran our backyard fed, we had over 100 kids from my high school come in and out of our backyard fed. And this was before we joined up with another group who we found via YouTube, which was the group that Joe Gacy and Alex Colon and those guys were from, if you're familiar with some of the CZW, you know, like GCW types. Our backyard fed consisted of Lince Dorado, Joe Gacy, Alex Colon, Amasis, myself. There was quite a few of us.
And with that, you say you were running the backyard fed. So what did running the federation entail then?
So we recorded weekly shows every Saturday. So somebody had to organize all the hooligans that wanted to beat each other up. So I played Booker. I decided, you know, kind of what matches, and I didn't necessarily say what storyline was going to happen between what characters. I kind of did it in an old school way, like, you guys will be in a program and we would build a monthly pay-per-view style show, like a, you know, blow off show every month. And eventually we got to the point where we had so many of us and we were so active doing it that we added a Tuesday show. So we'd record on Tuesdays and Saturdays. We'd record what we did and then we'd all sit together and watch it as a group on Saturday nights. And usually it would be at my house because I had a large basement. While we were in high school, I lived in my parents, you know, I had the basement in my family's house. So we could be kind of noisy and hang out down there and not really bother anybody.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. We go back to the match that inspired this whole conversation, John Cena and Eddie Guerrero in the parking lot. Very much felt like an early version of what we've seen a lot of this year as a result of the pandemic. It felt like the early version of a cinematic wrestling match.
Yes.
In the way that it was shot and in the presentation of it. I don't know whether you, have you had a chance to catch many of these cinematic wrestling matches in 2020?
So I haven't caught as many of the indie cinematic matches as I've wanted to, but I have watched the Undertaker, you know, one. I've watched the Bray Wyatt ones. I've enjoyed them. I genuinely liked the Bray Wyatt Funhouse match with John Cena a lot more than I liked the Undertaker AJ Styles match. They were both great. I don't want to take away anything from what AJ and Undertaker did. Like, they played to his strengths. They hit his weaknesses, and it was a great, if that is Undertaker's final match, that was absolutely a great way to send off the dead man. But the Bray Wyatt Cena match was more my type of cinema. Like, that's what I enjoy watching when I consume a movie or a television show or whatever the case may be. So I enjoyed that on a cinematic level a lot more.
From your backyard wrestling days, obviously, you moved into the world of, so it feels wrong to say legit wrestling, because it sounds like you had a legit operation in the backyard. So it feels wrong to say it that way.
We did. And this is a wild thing to say, and I'll kind of give you a little bit more background on that. When I met up with Joe Gacy and those guys, they were in a separate backyard fed. So we met, watched our trade of stuff on YouTube, because at the time in 2004, 2005, YouTube was full of skateboard videos, cat videos, and backyard wrestling. Because we're coming off of the craze of like the 2000-2001 era of backyard wrestling DVDs that were released in retail stores and the video games that came out. So like, we met up with these dudes and they had a wrestling ring. So we have backyard footage of us wrestling in a ring. So by the time we got to an actual school, which was at the time a joint Chikara and CZW school, we already knew how to hit the ropes. We knew how to bump. Not great, but we got to the point where wrestling schools are split up. Beginner and immediate advanced classes kind of deal, that they moved us right from beginner to the advanced classes because, you know, we were taking it as serious as we could, you know, like we were doing as best as we could to replicate what we saw happening on the indies and TV, you know, and such. So, yeah.
You from Philadelphia, where in the 90s and the noughties and probably back to the 80s as well, the wrestling scene's incredible in Philly, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who was somebody that you aspired to from the area when you were backyard working?
So when I was able to finally drive, like when I had my own form of transportation or hanging out with friends who did so, my very first independent wrestling show was an ROH show at the Murphy Rec Center, and the main event was a fatal four way between Samoa Joe, Dan O'Brien, Steve Corino, and I believe Homicide. The other matches on the show were Xavier defending the ROH title against Paul London. It had, you know, like Jody Fleisch wrestling on the show when he was still with that party group that all took the drugs, whose name I draw a blank now at the moment. Because it had like Cheech and Cloudy and, you know, like those type of guys in it. Special K, that was their name. Special K, it had the Hit Squad, which is Monster Mac, you know. It was a great, great card. And then, you know, we're also going to CZW shows at the time, which had El Generico, Kevin Steen, Ruckus, Nick Gage, you know, Zandig. You know, you had guys like Quackenbush. You had guys like Hero, Claudio Castagnoli. You had so many massive, Chris Sabin, Christopher Daniels. Like, I saw all these guys live and in person at the ECW arena. It was hard to not, you know, want to become a pro wrestler when you can just drive over to the ECW arena. It's just a 15-minute drive from where I lived and see this top quality, grade A stuff. Like, I was there when Necro Butcher fought Samoa Joe when IWA Mid-South did their show at the ECW arena. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's a very famous Necro Samoa Joe match that happened in like 2005. I was there for the World of Worlds stuff, you know, when ROH was running, competing against CZW in that time period too. It was just a great time for independent wrestling. I absolutely loved, when I was younger, Blackout, which was Ruckus, Eddie Kingston, Black Jeez, and I also loved Chris Hero at that time as a backyarder coming in. When it comes to like local independent guys, while they may not be local to Philly, they're who I saw,
you know, when I went to Philly shows.
You went into training as, and the training school that you went to was in the ECW arena.
Yeah,
I believe. Was there an intimidation, or what was the feeling in your in the pit of your stomach on that first day of training when you walk into like these hallowed halls to learn the craft?
It's surreal knowing that. It's one thing being a fan, right? And you're there when everything is set up and there's a barricade between you and the ring, and you know, like there's curtains between you and the wrestlers. But that first day when you walk through the back door, you know, like the entrance where the wrestlers go into, you know, as a fan, you never see this, like you never come into that port, and just to have nothing there but a wrestling ring in front of you, you know, like it's a good 100-150 feet away or so from the back door, and you're like, oh shit, like I'm actually here doing it. I'm sorry, I curse. I don't know if I was allowed to. I just got to slip down. Okay. And my first day going, like the first class, because they want you to see what it is first. But my first day, I'm watching a student do top rope hurricanranas with Claudio Castagnoli. Like that was my first day going to watch, and it blew my mind. I was like, this is exactly what I want to do. You know, like that's exactly what I want. I can do that. I've done that in the backyard. Like I'm ready to do that with Claudio as my base. It was surreal, especially because I had all my friends going into it. You know, like we all kind of came in at the same time, a little scattered because of money. You know, like some of us started a few weeks or a few months apart, but you know, a lot of us came in together at the same time. It was a cool thing to experience with, you know, my friends on my side as well.
From all the friends that you went into training with, was there anybody in particular that stood out to you and you thought that's going to be a big deal? Because you mentioned you did backyard wrestling with Lince Dorado, and of course, obviously, he's part of WWE now. But was there anybody at the training where you went, actually, they're going to be great?
I mean, yeah. Even Joe Gacy, who we backyarded with, is also under WWE contract now. He was recently signed. And, Lince, we always do, even when we were backyarding, because, I mean, the kid was doing what he's doing now. I can't say his kid, he's a grown-ass adult, but he was doing the stuff he was doing now, like in the backyard, like this footage of him doing 450s off ladders and stuff, you know, when we just had cardboard and some carpet on the ground to protect us, or not even protect us, to pretend to protect us. You know, you had Lince Dorado, obviously. Like, I mean, I was also trained under, you know, Sarah Del Rey. You know, I trained with Delirious. I trained with Chris Hero and all these guys. So, like, I was surrounded by eventual, you know, people that are now currently changing the business. You know, like, Cesaro may not be a WWE world champion, but that dude's a stalwart of, you know, like, the WWE scene. Like, you know whoever he's in the ring with, that he's being put in the ring with to get a quality match out of, right? Like, the dude's, like, a six-time tag team champion. Like, they can put him in any position, and he will succeed. Even somebody like Sarah Del Rey, who's now the assistant head coach in NXT, you know, I got to train under her for years, and all these experiences, all these people I got to, like, I was surrounded by people that were going to become something, you know, in some way.
When you began your training, is there a piece of advice that you were given that has stayed with you?
There's something that I still live by today, and that I still preach very much in my day-to-day life, and that's talent borrows and genius steals.
Who said that? Who coined talent borrows, genius steals?
It's not something that they came up with themselves, but it was something Mike used to say, and I kind of took it to heart and spun it in my own direction, you know, and what it means. But it was something that he preached to us about how we create what we do and what the choices that we make in the ring. There's a lot of meaning behind that if you allow yourself to kind of dig deeper beyond the, you know, the surface level, what it means to steal, you know, because it's not about like stealing somebody else's moves or stealing somebody else's look, right? We are a culmination of everything we've ever experienced in life, right? Every person you've ever spoken to, every media, all the media that you've ingested in your life, every conversation that you've had, all the things that you've chosen, the choices that you've made. They've all kind of formed your identity. You know, they led you to this specific point here, right? We, as humans, we watch something, we listen to something, and we kind of mimic it until we form our own identity, right? As children, we respond to our environment. We give back what we take in. And that's kind of like how we move on in life and how we develop who we are. And that should also exist in the way that you create art. don't be afraid to allow the things that you enjoy in life to influence who and what you are when you're performing. You know, and I can use myself as an example. I can use even high-level stuff like The Undertaker. There's a great story that was told about how The Undertaker formed his sitting up, you know, like routine he does in his matches. Like, you know, that's very iconic for The Undertaker now, which was taken from the Michael Myers movies, the Halloween films. He was directly told to kind of, you know, mimic that and take that. And, right, that is talent borrows, genius steals. And that's what I mean by that. Don't steal from within your own art form. Don't take from things that exist amongst your community. Don't be afraid to live outside of that in the real world and the pop culture and things that influence your life and bring it into what you love to do. Because there's a good chance it doesn't exist, right? Like, there are things that exist in comic books and movies and music and television that does not exist currently in the world of pro wrestling, and vice versa. Things that exist in wrestling that doesn't exist in those other art forms. And it's okay to allow those things to kind of, you know, cross-pollinate.
And you know there's some truth to that, because it's coming from the mind that created an Egyptian king cobra in the wrestling world.
Yeah.
So you know, and there's, you know, there's legitimacy to it.
There are so many little influences in who and what I am, from, you know, Serpentor in G.I. Joe to the number two in these Five Deadly Venoms film. He was the master of snake style, to stuff that is from like Clockwork Orange and Hellraiser, Mortal Kombat. Like, I take a little bit of everything and bring it into what I was to create who I was.
Because it's was it when you, because with Chikara, obviously it was its own very unique universe. Was it when you were part of the Wrestle Factory with Chikara where you formed that character? Was it something that was a general overlay given to you and you built upon it, or were you completely autonomous with creating Ophidian?
There was some back and forth. Not everybody was that lucky in that instance. There are some people that were told, this is what you're going to be, and this is how you should portray it. I was not one of those people. I had an email conversation. This was done via email, not in person. But, hey, I don't know what you should be at all. What are your ideas? And I got lucky in that sense, because usually – and this is true of WWE. This is true of, you know, Ring of Honor, doesn't matter what wrestling school you go to, your trainers, generally speaking, will help you with your first gimmicks. Like, you don't want to be what you've been waiting to be your whole life day one, because you're not going to be ready day one to do that, right? You're going to go out in front of an audience. You're going to have a lot of mistakes. You're going to fail, you know, quite a few times before you succeed. And I don't mean like you're going to be terrible, but if you're brand new to something, you know, like there's training wheels that you need to have before you ride your bike without them, right? Like, you need to have those moments. That's even true of myself. I was put under a different mask, a different gimmick for my first couple of matches to get those first match shenanigans out of the way, you know, where you're nervous in front of a crowd, you freeze up a little bit, you don't know what to do. This is true of every performer. You know, that first year or so can be rough. So, like, usually your trainers help you with that kind of stuff. But the difference with, like, Chikara at the time was that the training school led directly into the company, which is unusual for many promotions, the way that their setup was. So it was definitely a back and forth. And I got lucky with what I am, was I got to come up with a lot of who and what I was. I just had to match it with Amasis, who was told, like, you're going to be the Funky Pharaoh. Obviously, how he chose to portray it was on him, but you're going to be the Funky Pharaoh. This is kind of like the direction we want you to go. And because we were best friends growing up and we were a tag team when we backyarded, we had natural chemistry. So, like, we had a bunch of stuff already in the pocket. So it was a matter of me kind of matching who I was to make sure it fit him.
We had Still Life with Apricots and Pears on this podcast a couple of weeks back, and they told the story of how they got a message or a phone call saying, you are now Still Life with Apricots and Pears. And there was that moment, that period of time where there was a bit of confusion and a bit of, not frustration, but some concern, because it was like, I don't know what to do with this. But obviously we now know Still Life has gone on and they're becoming something incredible. And because you're working as, there you go. They're being honored today with a Still Life t-shirt. That's what it's all about. But when you were working as your assistant trainer at the Wrestle Factory, did you have many conversations with talent who were, in opposite to you, were given direction and said, I want to do this, I want you to do this? Did you ever have to deal with talent who had reservations about that?
I never had to say, this is what your gimmick is. However, because my wife and I made the gear for every graduate out of the factory, minus one or two that didn't have like traditional wrestling gear. There's some that, you know, like outside of the stuff that is, you know, out of the ordinary, we made every single graduate out of the school from 2015 or so forward, 2014, 2015. And there were lots of conversations where we would design what the character would look like. So we had some say in this is the way it's going to look in the ring. So I was able to have some of those conversations with some of the students, like, well, this is what you're going to look like, and your movements and movesets should match this kind of personality. But I never tried to limit what they are, because you don't know unless you experiment. You know, like, you need to kind of have some control over those kinds of things. And some of that control from others who ran the company wasn't really allowed. So I tried my best to allow that, you know, that expression to happen when I was training. I will say that at least with the Crucible stuff, which I had a way bigger hand in, and I got to train a lot of those guys and spend my time with them, that was where I was the most influential. That's where I was helping them come up with an actual style of wrestling that fit everything that we did and that they all matched each other. There was a complimentary, you know, moveset amongst all of them, and a complimentary vocabulary that they all shared while performing. And like the Crucible stuff and everybody that came from that angle, all those guys were trained, not primarily by me, obviously they went through the system, but that was the crew that I would say was my, you know, they were a result of, you know, spending the most time with me out of the factory.
We need to get to your second match for your DVD. So we've started off with John Cena and Eddie Guerrero in a parking lot brawl. What's your second match going to be, Ophidian?
So my second match, without a doubt, kind of a bit cliched, but it's without a doubt one of my favorite and helped form my identity as a child, because I was a kid when I saw this match, was Psicosis and Mysterio from ECW, their first meeting at the ECW arena.
And Psicosis thrown from the ring. Keep your eye on Mysterio. Up and over the top. And takes Psicosis into the first row with the plancha. Mysterio opening up the fuel tanks early. Up and over the top once again.
Build that idea that when we were kids, we thought ECW was real, you know, and WWE and all that stuff was fake. Because, you know, you had that conversation when you were in school, like, oh, ECW is the real wrestling.
Yeah, I remember I had those same conversations over here. Like, oh, it's hardcore, it's real, it's blood and guts, it's proper wrestling. Yeah. It's like, is it? Okay, sure.
There's a moment where a suicide dive happens and Mysterio and Psicosis are on the floor, and a suicide, like Tope and Hilo. And they just start, like children just pie-facing each other and clearly talking shit to one another. And there were little moments in that match like that. And we know now that those dudes are great friends. They were a peanut butter and jelly pairing. You know, like, they were always together and have been together their entire careers up until, you know, they separated in their, like, WWE-type stuff. But they were together for the nice first parts of their careers, so they had that kind of chemistry with one another where they can kind of be dickish and brutish with one another and it feel and look like they hated each other, like there was a genuine rivalry that they had. And there was a realism to their high-flying that you didn't necessarily always get when you watched, you know, like the light heavyweights in WWE or the other stuff that was kind of happening, like any like kind of like heavyweight stuff in WCW and stuff like that.
People were drawn into the edginess of it. And it was at the time as well with ECW, it was... Yeah. It was leading the way with that type of with bringing that Lucha Libre style into the US. It was really pioneering stuff. I mean, as a wrestler, when do you remember watching that for the very first time, that match?
I didn't watch it when it happened. So in the Philadelphia area, and maybe somebody has spoken to you about this before that's from this area, we had WGTV Channel 48 or 19, depending on the part of the, you know, Philadelphia, New Jersey area you lived, that had wrestling on every night of the week. We had ECW on Friday nights, but on, like, Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, you'd have Fake UTV from CZW, or had ROH in their weekly show, which I can't remember. NWA Wild Side, you know, was on WEW Extreme, Women's Extreme Wrestling. And this was a little bit later, but, you know, ECW was on local television. And then eventually, all the independent companies locally were on television. So you would get reruns of stuff on late night television at like 12, 1 in the morning. And of course, we taped traded. around these parts. So I first saw it on a rerun on TV on late night, and then found somebody that had a copy of it on tape that I was able to watch full on. That I watched a little bit older because I saw that just kind of like by happenstance, you know, at night one night, and thought it was like a fever dream of sorts. You know, like you're seeing this at 1 a.m. and you're like, these dudes are really doing what they're doing. I can't wait to go to school tomorrow and talk about it. But nobody else had seen it that night. You know, like, no, I'm telling you, this match was one of the best matches I've ever seen as a kid, you know, or on last night. And like nobody else had seen it until we found it on tape.
With that match, is there something from that particular encounter that stands out to you in particular? Like a moment move?
That moment where they're together on the floor and there's that like mini, like kind of the mini infight they have amongst each other.
It's again another reason why we believe that wrestling was, that the ECW stuff was real. It was that same, it was that energy from it. Would that have been the first, with that one, how deep into wrestling at this point were you? Obviously, you were a fan of it and you were doing the backyard stuff, but what year would you have watched this, did you say?
This would have been late 90s. So this would have been around like, you know, by the time Mysterio was picked up for WCW, we had rewatched this match. You know, like that's when we finally got it on tape, because at that point now we all knew amongst the friend group, like, oh, that's, you know, Mysterio. And it's not like he wasn't introduced to the United States audience before that. There was that pay-per-view that WCW did with AAA, where they had a AAA, the pay-per-view in America. That was in the early 90s, maybe 1992. I believe in 93. I can't remember the exact year. And I didn't see that live. Like, I didn't watch that in the moment. But, you know, he was introduced to the world, you know, along with guys like Eddie Guerrero and stuff very early. I've been a wrestling fan since I was as a kid. I can always remember being one. My father watched wrestling, so I watched wrestling as a kid. I know the very first match that sucked me in as a child. Like, not the one that I liked wrestling, but the one that made me love wrestling was Undertaker versus Undertaker at SummerSlam. And not that that was a great match. As an adult, I look back at that and go, that was not a good wrestling match. But right, it was a moment that I remembered as a child, because to me, that was something that only happened in comic books or cartoons, where there was two of the same person. You know, like, it blew my young mind, because I liked The Undertaker a lot. And, you know, the angle at the time was, this is the real Undertaker, the gray-gloved, gray-tied Undertaker. That was the real one, the purple one. You know, like, oh, whatever, he'd gone and disappeared. And they come back and they're face to face, and it was a magical moment as a kid, you know, to see that happen.
It's a big part of wrestling, and some people who we've talked to on this show are deeply invested in the actual literal wrestling in a match. But to many, as I'm discovering, it's about everything around it, and it's the suspension of disbelief. It is the characterization. It is the comic book element of wrestling, and it's something that Chikara became very well known for.
Like, I've often preached this, that the thing that we remember most about wrestling to the casual fan, to the person that we want to tune in and watch wrestling every week, or to maybe pay a ticket to come see us, the people aren't going to remember the moves. You could be the greatest technical wrestler in the world, and we need those. We need people that can keep that art form alive and have that on a show. But what they're going to walk away from that show are moments. You need a moment in a match where a dad and a kid, or a parent and a kid, I'm going to say dad, but a parent and a kid can both stop watching the match and look at each other in excitement and glee over what just happened. Our job is to create a moment that the audience member can share with their loved ones. You know, something that a parent will want to make their child experience as well. You know, like, and that's really like, that's how we've all, for the most part, gotten into wrestling. That's how it kind of passes on generationally. Like, my father watched wrestling because he had moments that he loved and cherished, right, that he wanted his son to experience. You know, it wasn't unnecessarily a specific move. Just like this persona in a ring is something that gives me good memories, that makes me feel good on the inside, makes me despise and I want to see him get punched, whatever that emotion is that they happen to feel, that they want their significant other, if it's a, you know, if it's a partner, or their children to experience with them. And that almost always will trump what we do in a wrestling ring as far as the moves and stuff go. And this is also coming from a guy that will do rope walk Egyptian destroyers and dive off a balcony and stuff. Like, I love the wild stuff. I love doing technical wrestling. I love that aspect of wrestling, but I'm also aware of, you know, like, at the end of the day, what we need to do in order to retain a wrestling fan and what's going to keep them coming back and bring their friends and family and such.
It will always be characters. Like, the, you know, that's why someone like The Undertaker has lasted as long as he has, because, like, you very rarely remember the matches, but you'll always remember The Undertaker, the character. Like, he kind of goes beyond wrestling, does that particular character. Mm-hmm. So you're right in what you say, that it's so much of it is character and development. And again, something Chikara was incredibly well known for, that comic book style presentation. When did you find out you were making your Chikara debut?
So I had wrestled because of the backyard stuff. I had snuck into the indies with some of my friends and had matches as early as 2006.
How did you get away with that? Did you fluff a little bit of what you already knew, or did you just I can come work?
Because we had experience in a wrestling ring, we didn't have to fake, like, how to hit the ropes and stuff. Like, we taught ourselves. We kind of – I'm not saying we were great, but we knew how to fake it. So, you know, we had a local wrestling school in the town I grew up in. I didn't grow up in Philadelphia proper. I grew up across the bridge. But I grew up essentially, like, what feels like a suburb of Philly, because I would go there as a kid. You know, I would cross the bridge to watch. I grew up in New Jersey. But we had a wrestling school in Pensauken that was run by Doc Diamond. We just showed up at his wrestling school and we're like, yeah, we know what we're doing, you know, and he ran local shows, you know, like that ran in the cheerleading, you know, facility, you know, on a Saturday night when they weren't using it, like, you know, turf field kind of stuff, or inside the gym that the school was in. So we kind of snuck onto those shows and had matches, and he would throw us on as an opener, you know, or like a pre-show kind of deal. But my first match, I knew a little bit ahead of time. Because my first match as Ophidian was on the road at a Mitch Ryder show in Indiana. It was XCW. And I also wrestled for CCW that same weekend. But my debut match was me and Shima Zion versus Lince Dorado and Corporal Robinson. It was quite the match. Like, obviously, Shima Zion would go on to do great things as well. You know, he's currently with WWE. I forget his new name.
Joaquin Wild.
Yeah, Joaquin Wild. Yeah. It was such a wild match. Because, like, that was my debut match on the indies as Ophidian. And I definitely, it was not a good match. I got knocked out.
Really?
I barely remember it. Yeah. It's common with wrestling. We get concussions. And not a good thing. But, yeah, I was definitely knocked out by the finish. And I don't remember the match. I'd seen it on tape, but I don't remember, you know, the match very well.
I was going to say, if you could recall the move that did it, or the moment that did it.
Yeah, it was a flipping top rope leg drop where I was hung over the ropes, like, you know, on the top rope hanging into the ring. And the top rope leg drop, the back of the heel caught me in the head and just knocked me out clean. I don't remember the finish. I remember waking up in the back. Like, I was not knocked out to the point where I couldn't move. I just was not – there was nobody home. My body was moving, but there was – the lights were, you know,
jeez,
nobody working the machinery in there.
Did that in any way deter you from getting into wrestling? But then I don't know whether, because sometimes something like that can shock the system a little bit and you can go, well, actually, I don't know if I want to go any deeper into this. But did it deter you in any way?
No, my about third or fourth week of training, I got sent to the hospital with a giant gash in my leg. So we were practicing what's called a bandera. It's a movement where, for those that are familiar with that, when you charge at somebody while they're standing in the turnbuckle and they bend over and they, as you're running at them, they lift you up and throw you out to the apron. That is referred to in Lucha Libre as a bandera. So practicing these banderas with Claudio as the person throwing us all over, because he could do it safely. But at the time I was like a buck 30 and, you know, he's a very strong and large man. So, when he gave me the bandera, I went way farther than I was supposed to, and my body landed on the metal post that is behind the turnbuckles, and it split my leg open, and I had to have multiple doctors close my leg. I had about 15 to 17 staples to close it. on my leg. And that was like my third or fourth week of training. And if that didn't deter me, then, you know, nothing was going to. I missed about a month of training because of it, but it was, you know, that didn't stop me. And I've had lots of injuries. Obviously, I'm retired now, but I've had lots of injuries in wrestling. And there's some that I'm like, I could have probably avoided those. Like, I could have probably avoided some of these, whether it's the jaw breaking or the broken arm, the torn MCL, you know, breaking both my thumbs, tearing the arch of my foot, multiple concussions.
Is there one in particular that you can think of where you think, actually, I could have avoided that quite easily?
Yeah, the broken jaw. The broken jaw. it was happening via 450. And at the time, it was when Amasis got into a car accident and had to retire for a little while. I got messed up from, you know, a bad car crash. And so I was doing the 450 in his honor. I knew Sugar Dunkerton was who I was wrestling at the time. So Sugar's on his back and I'm on the top rope. And I knew he wasn't placed properly necessarily. And I can't say new, but kind of had that feeling. I was like, I'm going to do it anyway. Like, it doesn't matter. It was the finish to the match. And I did the 450, and the point of his knees caught me right under the chin and cracked. And I could have just – it's wrestling. We can call audibles. If I did any of the move, the audience wouldn't have cared. But it was during a tournament show. So I was supposed – I was scheduled to win the tournament. Obviously it didn't happen because I broke my jaw in the opening match. Even though I won because of the 450, I landed on top of Sugar and the referee counted three because I was knocked out on top of Sugar Dunkerton. The referee doesn't know, you know, like I hit and my body was where it should be for 450 after hitting it. My second round opponent was AR Fox. And I wrestled a 1 minute and 30 second match with him. I went out there to do it to put him over, you know, and, you know, just to kind of give him the win real quick so that there wasn't a bye in the tournament. That was all my own volition. Nobody made me do that. But I went out there with a broken jaw. I taped my shit up and went out there and did a minute 30 match. Yeah.
Is it funny looking back and just thinking, how did I will myself to do that when you're taping your jaw shut?
I had to have my jaw wired shut for almost 4 months. Like, that was the result of the injury when I went to the hospital. And, like, yeah, I don't even know. Looking back at that footage, too, like, what was I thinking? Because I did a springboard in that match. Like, I did a springboard top rope Tigre, and then it was like, why? I could have done anything else. I could have not done the match. but, you know, like, we're young and dumb, and it's what we loved to do.
We return to my conversation with the brilliant Ophidian in just a moment. More great wrestling conversations can be found at Audible. Thousands of audiobooks ready for you right now, including by going to cultaholic.com/audible, a great selection of wrestling books as well, including Dylan Postel, aka Hornswoggle, Life is Short, and So Am I. The amazing story from inside, outside, and under the wrestling ring, read by Dylan Postel himself. How would you like that for free? You could do that by going to cultaholic.com/audible right now and subscribing to Audible for 30 days. Absolutely free. If after 30 days you have not fallen in love with Audible and its amazing selection of audiobooks, you can cancel. Won't cost you a thing, but you can keep the wrestling audiobook. That's a gift from us to you for trying Audible. Find out more at cultaholic.com/audible.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Where's been one of your favorite places to wrestle?
As far as, like, backdrop goes, I absolutely love the Channel Islands. And not because it's, like, the greatest wrestling promotion. The guys on the Channel Islands are, you know, a very small company. There's nobody of name value that's come from there outside of Benjamin Carter, who is currently just got signed to WWE.
It's opened up the rest of the world's understanding of the Channel Islands with Ben getting a gig, because people are going, oh, standout UK indie star. I say, well, is he from the UK? Because it's technically in the French Channel, so he's not really ours.
The people on that island aren't saying they're British, you know, like, no, we live in Jersey. We are our own people. We have our own currency here.
It has blown the minds of so many around the world that Jersey, the Channel Islands are in the UK. It's just blown their mind. It's been brilliant. And fair play to him.
There are so many people in the UK that don't know the Channel Islands are in the French, you know, like.
Oh, yeah. Some are in denial.
But I wrestled Benjamin Carter when he was 16 on a show, you know, in the Channel Islands. He's also wrestled, like, Frightmare and stuff, too. There's also quite a few of us, but I had a blast with wrestling, you know, a guy like Ben. But that place, because that island is just so beautiful and it's so nice, and it was the place that I would go to every tour. And every single tour I went out to, not even just UK, but my European tours, I would always stop there because it was a place I could decompress. It was a place I had friends. I made some really, really great friendships on that island with the people that worked there. And I knew I could just go and just rejuvenate. It wasn't necessarily, and they were great audiences, because when I would go there, I was the only person that did what I did when I would go there. You know, like, I was the only, not master wrestler, but only luchador there. You don't get many authentic luchadors. You do more so now. But when I started going to the UK in 2014, you know, we're few and far between. Like, guys that can practice, or sorry, not practice, that can perform authentic lucha in front of an audience. And, so, you know, it's very unique, and I was always very receptive from that crowd. I got to help book some stuff on that island as well, which I really loved. Like, I booked the first ever women's match on that island, which was between Heidi Lovelace and Kimberly. I got to do a lot of cool stuff there. But that's my favorite place to visit. One of my favorite places to perform ever is definitely with the TNT crowd up in Liverpool, because that audience is just it's great. They're loud, they're abrasive, you know, they like to drink. They were just a fun crowd to wrestle in front of. GCW crowds in Philadelphia, of course. Like, I absolutely love, one of my final matches was against Nick Gage, and I don't get booed very often, you know, especially at GCW. like, I still get cheered. You get the occasional guy that hates me, and that's great, because it's GCW, right? Like, you get both sides of it. But man, I was just relentlessly assaulted with boos that night, and I loved it. Like, there's something about that, because if the GCW crowd doesn't care, they'll just shut the fuck up and not, they just won't say a word, right? And they're not afraid to tell you you suck. They're not afraid to chant boring. They're not, you know, like, they will let you know they dislike you. But if you can get them to boo you and, like, you know, authentically do so and cheer you, like, you've earned a respect that will carry over throughout the rest of the world. I genuinely feel like if you can get over in Philadelphia in front of a crowd that will throw, you know, batteries at Santa Claus and beat up robots that are traveling the coast, you know, and do all the shit that Philadelphians do, throw chairs in a ring, you know, at the public enemy, and fill it with, you know, it's just, if you can get over with that crowd, you can get over with any crowd in the world.
So how proud were you to become such a mainstay in Philadelphia as part of Chikara?
I loved it. I enjoyed it a lot. I won't say, though, that was my favorite time in wrestling. I genuinely have enjoyed, I loved what I did, and I liked the people that I got to connect with, but I enjoyed my time more in other places like Demand Lucha in Toronto, companies like GCW, all the stuff I've done overseas in Europe. Like, there are experiences in wrestling that Chikara gave me the foundation, without a doubt. Like, I wouldn't have had the career I had if I didn't get my start in Chikara. But it was what I got to do with that foundation and where I got to go with it. You know, I wrestled in 20 countries around the world, which is something that very few people can ever say. That very few people have been out of their own country, let alone performed in 20 around the world.
I've got to ask about Jersey again and the Channel Islands, because you don't hear it come up in interviews very often. And for yourself, when you say you like to go there and you decompress, tell me some good places to go in Jersey to decompress.
So I spent most of my time in St. Helier, which is the main city. Like, that is the capital. I can't say for sure, but I believe that's the capital. Because the friends I had lived in St. Helier area. I loved going out to the beaches there, and there's one specifically. There's a castle about a mile or so out in the water that when the tide is in, you have to travel to that castle by boat. You know, it's a tourist attraction, but you have to go out there. But when the tide is out, because it is like the world's largest tide exists on Jersey, you can walk out on a concrete path that's just out in the middle of essentially the ocean. You know, like, you're walking out into the ocean a mile or so deep, and it's just a beautiful sight. You know, like, when the water's out and you've got all this like algae and stuff and like the sand and just these little pockets of what you normally don't get the chance to see, because we can't see underwater. That, you know, like, we don't get to see the ocean floor. And while it's not the ocean floor, I'm not saying that it's, you know, it's the same as going, you know, out in the middle of the water, but there's this feel to it that I don't feel anywhere else, you know, like a visual to it.
There's something about being so far away. Like, my dad will always say he loves when he's on holiday, because he's so far away from work that if something goes wrong, he can't do anything about it anyway. And that is part of his decompress. Is that the same with you going to Jersey?
Yeah. When it's nighttime, you know, like, there's no major city lights, there's no crazy music blaring, it's just quiet. You know, like, even in their biggest city, and I say biggest with quotations, it's an island with 100,000 people on it. Like, it's just quiet. It's quiet during the day, it's quiet at night. And you can go there and genuinely just be in silence, you know, and that's hard to get where I live. I live in the city in Philadelphia. You can't see the stars at night because of the pollution and stuff, you know, but you can go to a place like that and there's nothing blocking it. Like, everything is beautiful all the time. I remember after one show, we would wrestle at a venue on that island that was, it was like a surf venue. Like, you know, like, they had a bar and a music venue attached to it, but like, it was popular because it was a place where you could surf at, like, that side of the island. But the tide is out and it's nighttime and I'm out in the water because I wanted to walk away from the party happening after the show. And just kind of like take it in. And the ocean floor, because of the way the moonlight had hit it, it looked like space. Like, the ripples in the ground and just the way everything was kind of visually looking, it looked like I was on another planet. I had walked so far away from the venue out into the water because the tide was out that it felt like I was in some place that didn't exist anywhere else in the world. And that is something that will always stick with me. Like, that moment where I can kind of look around and feel like I'm in a completely different planet almost. It's something that, you know, I'll always have with me.
You've traveled all over the world wrestling, and you retired back in June. It was a very sudden announcement of retirement, and it was surrounded by a lot of other bad things happening in the wrestling world at that time to cut through it. What was the moment where you decided, I actually don't want to wrestle anymore, I'm done?
I had, this is something I talked about my wife a while ago. I wanted to retire by the time I was 30 if I didn't do what I wanted to do in wrestling. Not because I thought 30 was like, you're old and, you know, that's when you have to stop. But I just know I'm beat up, I'm broken. Like, I've done martial arts my whole life. I played sports as a kid, racked up a lot of injuries. And I still kept going. And I remember having a sit down conversation with my wife back in 2018, being just unhappy with where I was at, even in Chikara, and wanting to leave and all that. And there was a time where I switched my mask up to the style, what I refer to as the Ouroboros, where I got rid of the classic head. I still wore it for places that wanted me to wear it, but I switched to an open eye format. I completely changed my look up and the way that I portrayed my character, and that kind of reinvigorated me. I've kind of lost my love. You know, I lost my smile, so to speak. You know, the quote, very famous wrestling line. I didn't want to do it anymore, necessarily. You realize that somewhere along the line, when you're that unhappy and you have to do so much work, there's other things in your life that are probably also feeding into you being unhappy. There was definitely a lot of depression associated with it that I'd never taken care of. You know, like there was definitely some mental health issues that, and this is not just a me thing, that's a thing that we tend to do in pro wrestling, kind of ignore because of the industry that we're in and the things that we kind of force ourselves to do. You have to be a bit masochistic to be a pro wrestler, right? There's a level of self-harm that we do to ourselves every single time we perform that we have to accept. And that kind of, if you don't manage your own mental health, if you don't manage your own like kind of internal being, you can kind of fall victim to that stuff over time and it really affect you. There's just a lot of little things throughout life that kind of built up, and that was a decision that was necessary, without a doubt.
Did you feel like you talked there about sort of falling out of favor, falling out of love, losing your smile with wrestling? What was it that caused that? We go from talking about how much you love life in the Channel Islands and being that free and that away, and it's a shame that we jump from that to you just losing that passion for it. And I was curious as to what had caused that change in you.
A lot of it had to do with my time in Chikara, to be honest with you. And there's a lot I'm grateful for, and I'm not ever going to speak badly about my time performing in front of an audience. I absolutely loved that aspect of what I was doing, but I didn't like what I was and what I was doing within the company and how it essentially drained everything that I had as a human being. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I will always that will go unspoken that I did that nobody will ever know for not just for that company, but just overall for wrestling, whether it be with the gear making. You know, like we did all the gear making for the company. I was teaching there. I did a lot of video editing and stuff for the company. A lot of the Crucible stuff even was stuff that came out of my computer, that came from my home, that I created and built, that would never get credit for, that would never nobody would ever know that I have done or my wife has done. Hell, even, you know, without getting too deep into it, you know, like my wife is part of the Crucible angle as Strix. And the videos that were leading up to our reveal, and was fired from the company for promoting her music that she made for the Crucible angle. So there was just a lot of little things that just what was that because of how dedicated I was to where I was at with the company, that led into other stuff that kind of made me essentially fall out because I was unhappy with where I was at, which led me to change the character, which led me to other companies, which is where you saw from out of nowhere I appeared all over the indies again because I was tired of where I was at and what I was doing. I didn't want to be there anymore, but I felt a level of I'm drawing a blank on the right word, but I had all the people that I was helping train and stuff that I felt like I had to be there for, you know. It's not their fault, the unhappiness and stuff, but you know, it happens, man. Some places just you grow out of, and you know, you stay in relationships too long sometimes because you're comfortable, and sometimes it's to your, you know, like in this case it was to my own detriment and my own mental health.
To go behind the curtain, like coming to chat to you today, one of the things that I was going to talk about, and you know, I even used some of the language early on where I said we'll celebrate your time at Chikara, but as we're talking, you know, I've realized it wasn't the happiest of times for you. So before I go anywhere else, I want to apologize for bringing it up in the way that I did, and if it felt like if it was something you didn't want to talk about. So
no, not at all. Like I said, I will happily talk about everything that's happened in front of the curtain. You know, like, because there were genuine things that I loved about, I got to wrestle El Generico there. I got to work with, I've got to work with the Young Bucks. I've got to work with, guys like Player Uno. I've got to work with Claudio Castagnoli. I mean, I got to wrestle some of the most amazing performers that exist in the world today. There's so much that I loved about my time performing in ring. All of my animosity comes from what happened behind the curtain, that, you know, I will not let affect what I did in front of the camera, because what I did in front of the camera I enjoyed.
When you officially announced your retirement, how did you feel?
It was a lot. I'm glad that I'm moving on to something else. There's a lot in my life. Obviously, like, I've done video editing, not just for wrestling, but that's what I went to college for. And I'm still doing video editing now for my wife and her live streams. There's obviously gear making and stuff going on that I've been doing now for years. There's a lot of things that I have my hands in that I enjoy doing, that I want to be able to do, that I want to be able to focus on. And essentially saying that out loud and being able to do that, I would say in a way I gave myself permission, you know, to be able to pursue those other things without feeling guilty about it.
I want to talk about your mask making because you, as you say, you've made ring attire for wrestlers all over the world, masks and other. I know you and your wife recently made some stuff for Jessica Havoc, which looks amazing. Where did that strand of things come from for creating ring attire and masks? When did that start?
My wife is the kind of seamstress where her grandmother was a seamstress, her mother was a seamstress. She grew up working in a theater with her mom. You know, like she's been sewing her whole life. So there came a time where this was during the shutdown angle of Chikara, where my gear maker fell through and I needed a set of gear from out of nowhere. Like, my gear maker was supposed to have gear in a few weeks for me and just told me they can't have it. I'm fucked. I need gear for my return under, like, the white set of gear that I used to have, the Undead Ophidian. And she made it for me. And once she made one set of gear for me, and other wrestlers were like, oh, where'd you get that gear from? It kind of turned into, well, yeah, she makes stuff, and she'll make stuff for this guy, then she'll make stuff for this guy. And then now, this is 2013 when it first happened, and it slowly snowballed into, well, maybe we can do it as a business. Because my wife at the time was a full-time burlesque dancer and making costumes regularly anyway. Because when you're burlesque, you're making costumes, new costumes all the time to perform in front of audiences. She also made costumes for other performers and such too. But yeah, it turned in from her making just a single set of gear for me to making it for others. And then I got to the point where we were investing in our business and I was helping, you know, kind of like fund the all the industrial machines we have in our home and upgrading all of our equipment with wrestling as well. And I was investing in that because I knew there would come a time where I could stop working my 9-to-5 job and move into that aspect of professional wrestling. Because there's more to wrestling than what goes on in front of the camera, right? There are so many aspects. A majority of wrestling happens behind the scenes. You know, like, we spend in 3 hours, you know, at an indie show if you're unlucky. Hopefully only like 2 to 2.5 hours, you know, at a total indie show wrestling. But for the rest of the weeks leading up to that, there's so much work happening behind the scenes. And that's what I really love about professional wrestling, is the stuff that goes on behind the curtain and how to, you know, how the fabric we choose helps manipulate a live audience, or helps them determine who and what you are. You know, it helps kind of influence the way they see a persona, or the way that we put together a video package, how it, you know, generates a feeling out of you of joy or animosity or disgust or whatever, you know, whatever it is we're aiming for you to feel about a specific performer. I love that aspect of entertainment, how we manipulate media, how we manipulate fashion, how we manipulate all the other aspects of what we do to make you feel the way you do when it comes time for the 10 minutes that I have to perform for you in the ring.
What makes a good wrestling mask?
A lot of people are afraid to go all in on what they are. And what I mean by that is they don't want to be too colorful or too gimmicky or too anything. But if you're going to get to the point where you're a masked performer and you're going to wear a mask, well, you're already, like, this is a blank canvas to do with whatever you want. And not being afraid to go all in is very important. You know, like, you don't necessarily have to be cartoony to be visually appealing. You know, you don't have to be realistic to be, or, like, use realistic materials to look realistic. And, you know, like, there's a lot of things that you can do. And not being afraid to go all in on what your gimmick is and what your gear, I'm sorry, not gimmick, on what your gear looks like is very important. I think also understanding, like, contrasting colors, and there's a lot of things as far as, like, theory for, like, the way something should look, but the colors that you choose, the placement of these symbols, the shape of your eyes, all these things matter to the way somebody is going to portray you. You know, the slant of an eye from like one direction to another, like a little more slanted down inward, right? Makes you look a little more evil versus pulled back and, you know, like straight kind of like gives you more of a approachable look and, you know, like how small your eyes are, how big they are on top of the colors that you choose to surround it. Like there's so many aspects of it that people ignore when they're talking to a gear maker, you know, that I have to constantly explain to them.
It's the subtle things that make all the difference. And it's stuff that, like, also the obvious things that sometimes people miss. Like you say, it's like positioning of the eyebrows and the shape of the face that can denote a good guy, a bad guy, a hero, a rudo. It changes so subtly. Who would you say, and I can't say the best because it's too broad a palette to pick a colour from, but who would you say has one of the best masks in wrestling?
If we're going modern day, there was a few dudes who I really, really like. One is Drago. When I mentioned going all in on what you are, there is no doubt what that, you know, what Drago is. That dude is clearly a dragon. You know, like there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You won't ever second guess that. And I think right, stuff like that is very important. Like that is wrestling. I mean, that's also very Lucha Libre as well. You know, like he's embodying a very animalistic traits to become what he is. Drago is a really good example. I like when it comes to like modern day masks like that, alongside like even what Great Muta is doing now, like the kind of like the silicone leather masks that he wears on occasion that have like the claw, like the kind of like alien kind of claw stuff on them. Older masks, I love the simplistic look of classic Lucha. Like obviously like guys like Blue Demon and stuff is really iconic, but I like the generation of stuff after that. I really like the big horn trend that was happening out of the late 80s and early 90s with guys like Liger and Psicosis and stuff like that have these giant, you know, horns coming off of their masks, because it reads a lot to an audience. Like you can be in the nosebleed seats and know that dude is larger than life, because he's got these giant attachments to his costume that make him larger than what they really are. And I love stuff like that as well.
Next week is the penultimate episode of Desert Island Graps for 2020, and it features European wrestling star, Germany's own John Klinger, who you may know as Bad Bones.
Winners never quit and quitters never win. That's the only way to go. So that shot is going out from me to AEW. I'll see you guys soon.
Now, before we get to your third and final match, we like to spring this on people. We're going to give you the chance to choose to take with you to the island, as well as three wrestling matches, a movie, an album, and a luxury item. And I always like to spring this because I always like to see what movie sort of sits at the top of people's psyche when I say your favorite of these. So if I was to tell you you could take a movie, what would the movie be that you would take?
This is worse than your three favorite matches.
I know, right? Isn't it a stinker?
I'm going to have to take a step back on that if I can answer the other ones.
Of course. Well, do the album one first then. What album would we take?
So I think I would take an Aesop Rock album, either Labor Days or Impossible Kid. There's something about the way those two albums resonate with me. Like I can quote almost the entirety of Labor Days as an album. And Impossible Kid is a little bit of his newer stuff, so I can't quote it as much as I could Labor Days, but I get the same. It resonates with me the same emotionally, because it's clear, like, you know, he's older and there's a level of maturity he has to that album that I really enjoy. And I'm a hip hop a fan through and through. And the older stuff could be a little bit more spoken word than his more modern stuff, but both of those albums hold like a special place with me. There's nothing that I love more than, like, you know, lines like off of the track Labor Days, 9 to 5's anthem, where he talks about, you know, we the American people hate the 9 to 5 day in, day out, while we'd rather be supporting ourselves by being paid to perfect the pastimes that we've harbored based solely on the fact that it makes us smile if it sounds dope. And like stuff like that, just like that was my mindset through wrestling. Like, I'm doing this not because it makes me money, but because it makes me smile, right? Like, it makes others smile. There's a joy being had off of just making art because it's fun to make art, not because it makes you money.
Is there a particular moment in your life? Obviously, we say how Aesop Rock connects to the wrestling. Is there a particular moment in your life that you have an Aesop Rock song as the soundtrack to?
Yeah, so one of my first trips to Japan, my first trip to Japan was with 01, and I made a specific playlist to take that trip. And Lucy off of that album was the song, one of the songs I chose from Aesop for that. And along with some songs from like The Addicts and things like that. Some NoFX, and I'm a fan of punk music too. But Lucy, there's a line in that song that I've never had a dream in my life because a dream is what you want to do but still haven't pursued. And at that time, for me, I was like, I'm doing it. I'm making it, right? Like, somebody else paid for me to travel to another country to perform at Kurikan Hall. Like, my debut in Japan was at Kurikan fucking Hall. And, you know, in 2010 with 01, where I got to wrestle. On that tour, I wrestled both Miranu Sawa and Hidaka. And Hidaka, obviously, you know, is a legend among in light heavyweights. Yeah, like, my mind was blown. That was definitely that's Lucy off of the Labor Days album, for sure.
Amazing. How about a luxury item? Like, so, a creature comfort from home. It could be something to keep you occupied on the island. It could just be a keepsake that you want to have with you to remember life before the island. I'll give you some anything over the years. So we've had like some of creature comforts. James Storm wants to take toilet paper. Nick Aldis wants to take his Jag just to drive around the island. I guess
I'm a gamer, so I would have to go with a PSP.
Nope.
And I would choose a PSP over a DS because I also have a DS. And I'd say PSP because I love the RPGs, and RPGs on the PSP are a little more diverse. You know, you can the Final Fantasy games especially.
Stephen Dennis is a fan of yours who I mentioned to him that you were coming on, and I said, I know you're a big Ophidian fan. Is there anything you want to talk about with him? And he mentioned RPGs to me. So, which RPG are we talking here? Which is the ultimate one? I know it's difficult to choose, but is there a particular one that stands out to you?
As like a personal favorite, it's not the best RPG I've ever played. There are better ones. But Legend of Dragoon on the PS1 is one of my favorite RPGs ever. I love the weird gameplay mechanics that it has. I love the story. It's not the best RPG. There are better RPGs I've played fundamentally that I know are better, but I played Legend of Dragoon at the right time when I was a kid and absolutely loved it. Lost Odyssey on Xbox 360. I'm currently playing Kadelka, which is a survival horror RPG. The Shadow Hearts franchise as a whole I love. Like, yeah.
Have you played the Final Fantasy VII remake? I know a lot of people talked about that as sort of something that was sort of kickstarting RPGs into the modern era again. I don't know whether you played it.
Not yet, because I don't own a PS4. Mm. I'm an Xbox player, so it is scheduled to come out for Xbox, but I have to wait.
Hold fire on it. Do you think there's obviously with a lot of gaming now seems to revolve around a lot of online first-person shooting, a lot of massively multiplayer online games rather than like the traditional RPGs, the stuff that we've talked about today. Can you see those making a comeback at some point?
I don't think they've ever gone away. No? I think they've turned into something a bit different. If you look at the Mass Effect franchise, Mass Effect, to me, that is a great modern-day RPG. While it may not be turn-based in the, you know, what we think of as like classic JRPG stuff, that is what a modern RPG looks like. Not Andromeda, which unfortunately wasn't, you know, like, kind of took a step back, but the main line, the Mass Effects 1 through 3, they did a lot of stuff right. And it's what I think an RPGs can look like today. And there's still, I don't feel it's ever gone away. I feel like there are a lot of games that have taken elements of RPGs and incorporated it. Like, I play Destiny 2 regularly, and that is trying to dive deeper into the RPG side of things, because that's where you get investment from a personal standing, like being able to custom build your character and create and mold and craft all these specific builds is very RPG. you know, like, those are things that we love RPGs for, and you get a lot of first-person shooters and stuff taking that aspect of RPG and incorporating it. So what you're getting now, just like with pro wrestling, how there isn't just one style of wrestling anymore. You know, you were either, if you were a luchador, you only did Lucha Libre in Mexico. You know, if you were an American pro wrestler, you did the classic American, like, you know, brawling style. But you don't get that anymore, right? What we have now on TV, especially with AEW and Ring of Honor and Impact, is this complete hybrid of what wrestling, you know, needs to look like in the year 2020, which is that mix of both. You know, guys like Keith Lee who can fly and, you know, beat you up. You know, he can powerbomb you just as much as he can do a Topek and Hilo. You know, Donovan Dijak is another great example of that. Guys in AEW like Orange Cassidy, who can do a little bit of both, you know, who can do like classic American stuff, or he can do Lucha Libre. You know, like, you got these, what's popular now are guys that can do that. And I think that applies to gaming as well.
The little elements of RPG creeping into other gaming styles and platforms and formats, because, as we've talked about, talent borrows, ingenious steals. It ties in, comes all the way back around. I've got to get your movie now. Before we move on,
I will talk all night about all these things that you're bringing up. I would happily talk over and over and over again about everything we're talking about here, or in more depth. You said movie. That's the last one I have to answer. And see, that's tough for me. I was delaying it because, like, as much as I love all movies. Throw them into school for. I love cinematography. There's so many movies that. It's whether or not I want to see something visually over and over again. You know, I'm a big fan of stuff from like 70s Italy, 70s and 80s Italy, like the giallo films and all that. I love classic kung fu martial arts. I love modern day martial arts stuff. You know, whether it be stuff from like Thailand and Indonesia, like the Tony Jaa stuff from Thailand, or the stuff that's happening like with the Raid and Headshot movies like that out of Indonesia. I love classic American stuff. I love 80s American movies as well. Stuff with, you know, Stallone and Kurt Russell. Like, it's so hard for me to pick something. But if I had to, I think I would go martial arts, because I love, it's what I really love. And the Raid and or Raging Phoenix being two of my more like modern martial arts films that I really love.
Nice. That felt like a difficult choice to make. And I respect
and
that.
It really is. Yes.
Okay, you have one final match for your DVD to choose. So we've had John Cena and Eddie Guerrero competing inside a parking lot, or surrounded by cars. What would you like for your third and final match, sir?
This is not going to be a popular one, but it is definitely one of my favorite of all time, and that is Goldust versus Roddy Piper from WrestleMania. In the Hollywood parking lot brawl.
Oh, the backlot brawl!
Roddy Piper facing Goldust, who's on the backlot as we speak.
Little puppet, made of pine, white the gift of life is thine. Pinocchio, 1940. President Piper, that's a poor imitation. But for now, we'll have to do. But yes. When you're in my back lot, President Piper, it will be the real thing, won't it?
Piper was hit by a car. This is over. We'll return. What's he doing now? Look out! Look out! Roddy's going after him, I think.
He
is it just wrestling in parking lots that is the is the thing? Are we getting a weird I don't want to use the word kink because they throw that around too long. But are we into wrestling?
Fetishizing the parking lot. Yeah.
Because we could have chucked in Steve Blackman, Ken Shamrock, Iron Circle match if we're doing that.
Hey man, the stuff that even that was happening with the Lion's Den matches and stuff too, I loved.
Yeah.
I love gimmicks. I love gimmicks in wrestling. I went out of my way to like the Chamber of Horrors matches from WCW, all the stuff from Halloween Havoc when Hogan and Macho Man fought the Dungeon of Doom, you know, like the Allegiance to End Hulk Hogan, whatever the fuck their name was. That all that stuff I absolutely love. I love gimmicks in my wrestling matches. But yeah, that the Hollywood the backlot brawl match, because it had a little bit of everything, man. I really liked the Goldust character as a kid, and I do as an adult. There's a lot of nuanced things they did with his character that you did not get from that time period. And while some of the stuff doesn't necessarily translate to 2020, there's some things that we look back at and go, that might have been crossing the line, you know, when it comes to certain the ways that we portray characters like Goldust. And obviously, like, you know, you'd have a different performer doing that kind of persona now. But we have to take what you can get, you know, when it comes to that time period and that era, you know. But the things about the Goldust character that I really loved, and even before that, his feud with Razor Ramon over the IC title when he got Razor Ramon tattooed on himself, you know, and like went that far as a character. There's just so many little things that I loved about that. And I don't mean loved as in like I enjoyed him as a babyface. I genuinely liked booing him. And as an adult, I look back fondly on that character. I'm like, I actually really liked him. But as a kid, I really liked, you know, booing him. And the stuff he did with Piper was just great. And there was a real raw emotion with Piper pulling out a baseball bat, right, and smashing at the car, hosing each other down. Even the weird, awkward finish, you know, where throughout the night they were cutting back to the match and they did the O.J. Simpson car chase.
Oh, the use of the O.J. Simpson footage is something that went over my head when I watched it as a young kid, but later on as an adult, greatly appreciated.
I knew as a kid what that was because I'd seen the O.J. stuff. Like, I had watched the O.J. stuff on TV with my family. Like, I'd seen that, so I knew what that footage was and recognized that. And, at the time, I didn't understand why necessarily, like, they were doing it, but I knew what that was, and there was, like, an element of, like, oh man, he's just as bad as OJ. You know, like my mind as a kid was associating what was happening with the OJ stuff with that match. And even down to the weird finish where he derobes Goldust in the ring and he's wearing, you know, lingerie underneath. There's just so much weirdness about that match. But that match can be talked about and broken down on so many levels that a normal wrestling match can't be. You know, like a straight up technical match, we can talk about the nuances of the movements and stuff, but there's a level of storytelling that match tried to do. I'm not saying it was super successful, but that it tried to do that we could debate about.
Do you think the reaction to that match is different now? Because we've had a whole year and it's quite nice that we sort of bookend this with this. We've had a year of cinematic wrestling matches. So people have kind of become used to the idea of these of wrestling matches being mini movies. Do you think that match would have a different reaction had it played out today?
Yes, without a doubt. I think that part of what made that match for me work was seeing – and at the time I didn't know Goldust had been wrestling, you know, for like 15 years or so at that point, right? Like I didn't know he was Dustin Reynolds for as long as he was. But to me, Goldust was a newer character, right? Like, oh, like here's like this, right? It's like youth versus I have to draw the blank a lot. Like, you know, the old guard versus the new guard in a way, and like this cross – this. Things that shouldn't work, but Piper was also such a good promo. You know, like, there's so many things that worked well that I think you could redo that kind of match now with the right characters, and it would be just as fun and entertaining. We might be more accepting of it, for sure. But also, the character itself wouldn't exist in the same way today as it did back then. Piper still would, but not Goldust. Goldust now is going to look a little different than he did, you know, in the early 90s.
And certainly be received in a very different way as well.
Yes. And respectfully so. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there are things that we shouldn't do in ways that we portray what his character was attempting to portray. We should portray differently. But I love the idea of a cinemaphile as a performer. I love the idea of somebody that studied film the way that he did and was the cinephile that he was, and how he incorporated movie into his, you know, that art form. He's stealing from one art form and bringing it to another, you know, in pro wrestling. I want more of that, because you don't get that very often. You don't get that I'm a master of this craft and I'm coming over to this art form with the mastery I have of this craft over here. You know, and he was a master of film, or, you know, at least we were told he was.
And it's been amazing to spend some time with you, a fellow master of your craft. And I'd love to send people to where they can find you and your good lady online, and go ahead and plug whatever you want to plug here, Ophidian.
Nowadays, you can find myself and my wife on Twitch at twitch.com/KateNix or KateNix.live, where I'm a part of her weekly stream on Tuesday nights. Right now, we're during the off season. We do 7 weeks on, 5 weeks off. We just started the off season, but you can catch our replays of the shows that I helped craft with her every Tuesday night. We also do weekly streams out of our studio on Thursdays and Saturdays, where you get to watch us sew all the things that we make for professional wrestling. We make gear for all types of performers all over the world. You can also catch us on Patreon at patreon.com/closetchampion. Where we talk about gear making and music and all types of things wrestling related. We have a Discord attached to it that is private to that Patreon, where you can come spend and pick our brains about everything, not just gear related, but of pro wrestling as well, if that's what you'd like to do. But it's a way for other makers to communicate. We have a lot of gear makers on our Patreon with us, part of our Discord as well. So we have a large community of gear makers and just makers in general, not just of gear, but masks and other things that we make in that community, to be able to ping pong ideas off of and to communicate with about how to do something. Or you can just follow me across all social media at Ophidian Cobra, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, all the stuff. And of course, I forgot to plug the Closet Champion YouTube channel, where you can find all of the videos we do teaching you how to make masks and other gear related stuff.
Does it feel nice to still be playing such a prominent role within the wrestling world without any chance of breaking your jaw?
The biggest thing I have to worry about now is sticking pins into my fingers.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
For all the wrestling headlines in just 10 minutes, search Cultaholic Wrestling News on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.